little bit more review here and we'll be back to where we were. Today we are talking about infinitives, and then we left off on page 197 looking at, we had already looked at the forms of the infinitive, and now we're looking at the uses of the infinitive. First, the uses of the anarthrous infinitive. And the first use was the complementary infinitive. That kind of completes the idea of certain verbs, and a certain class of verbs, dunamai, to be able, and fellow, to want, and so forth, that will take infinitives as a sort of complement to the idea of the verb. And so there's a list of a number of examples of these. And these auxiliary verbs are often very irregular in their paradigms as well, as you see in the footnotes. Now, looking at the top of page 197, there's a remark here that's very important. In the illustrated passage cited above, the subject of the main verb is also the subject of the infinitive. When this is not the case, and whenever the subject of the infinitive is separately expressed, it is placed in the accusative case. So here's something to remember. The subject of an infinitive, if it's not the same as the subject of the main sentence, is going to be in the accusative case. And a couple of examples here quickly, but we see this kind of thing very frequently later on. Gnoskein humas bulomai, I want you to know. So bulomai is I want, and then gnoskein is your infinitive, to know, but then humas is you, I want you to know. And the you is in the accusative case here. And so it's the subject of the infinitive, but the whole phrase is the object of the main verb. So the idea of object being in the accusative case is not that strange here, because in effect the object is the whole infinitive phrase. I want something. What do you want? I want you to know. So the whole phrase is the object, and so the subject of that infinitive, if it's being expressed there, is in the accusative case. Okay, then point number two, anarthrous infinitives also occur as subjects of verbs which ordinarily govern substantive objects. So they can occur, excuse me, as objects of verbs which ordinarily govern substantive objects. So an infinitive, anarthrous infinitive can occur even with other verbs, aside from these auxiliary type ones and so forth. They can occur with other verbs that normally would take a noun as a direct object. An infinitive can function that way. And here's a couple of examples. These are pretty straightforward and very common usage. As they tune, out tone, kratesai. They were seeking to seize him. So they were seeking something. What were they seeking? They were seeking to seize. And the idea of to seize is the infinitive there. Yes?
Well, I was thinking, out tone is accusative here.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, they could mean they were seeking him to seize, that he would
yes.
be seizing
him. Right.
If you replace gnoskein, they were seeking him to know.
Right.
Or you could mean they were seeking to know him.
Right. It could. Well, context is going to be your primary guide in a situation like that. The context itself, and which makes the most sense, is going to be the only thing you're really going to be able to go by. And that is one problem. But when you have an infinitive, if the infinitive has an object, it will be an accusative case. If the infinitive has a subject different than the subject of the sentence, it will also be an accusative case. It's conceivable to even have both of them in there. And then you'd have the problem of telling which one is which. But you'd have to go by context primarily here. And what would seem, yeah, there are certain verbs, you see. There are certain verbs, because of the meaning of the verb, that lend themselves more to, you know, I wanting or desiring or something like this would be more appropriate for a usage where the accusative was the subject of the infinitive. Whereas a verb like seeking, and especially the idea of seeking information and so forth, or seeking to do a certain thing, it's more appropriate the other way. So, and then, of course, that plus the context can usually resolve the matter. But formally, there wouldn't be any way to tell, and it's certainly not word order that would tell.
So you could have two usages, like, I want you to know him.
Right, exactly. I want you to know him would be precisely that situation. It'd be gnoskein humas, you know, auton bulomai, or something. Or bulomai gnoskein humas auton. I mean, the word order would be variable there. And that would be another situation. And there you might have an ambiguity of I want you to know him or I want him to know you. It'd be about the same, the wording would be about the same. In many cases they may just avoid that altogether just by splitting it up, writing it in two sentences or something like that. But or just if the context is sufficient. If it's obvious from a previous sentence that he's talking to you, then you get it straight. If it's obvious from a previous sentence he's talking to him, then, you know, are about him, then you get it straight that way. So there will be instances where context is going to have to be your helper in this. Hebrew students are used to this because it's about every sentence you need the context to decide something. All right. Then thirdly, when an infinitive together with subject and object or other adjuncts is present, is the object of a verb of saying or thinking, it is said to be an indirect discourse. So here's one way that indirect discourse is expressed in Greek, and we can translate this in English in a pretty literal way and still get some meaning out of it, although it's not as commonly done. This is only one of the Greek constructions which correspond to the English indirect quotation. In translating such constructions, the English sequence of tenses should be followed. Look at the examples and make that apparent here. Acts 28:6, Elegon auton enai theon. They said that he was a god. Okay, literally, it would be they said him to be a god. Here again, we have two accusatives, auton in the accusative and theon. And you decide which is which, you kind of go by those definite criterion again. Auton is the pronoun, and theon is a nominal, so the pronoun would be preferable as far as this object to be infinitive, and the other would be the object. But notice, though, that it's literally, they said him to be a god. They said him to be a god. That's kind of the idea of the literal. And in English, we can say it that way, although it's probably not as commonly done. So they translate, they said he was a god. Notice they put the verb was there for the infinitive, to be. And that's what they mean by sequence of tenses, as it were. They're trying to, since the finite verb was in the past tense, they put the other verb in the past tense as well, although in the Greek the infinitive is all that's used. Okay, and then logizomata dikaiustai piste anthropon, we hold that a man is justified by faith. Here again, we hold, logizomata, we reckon, that a man is justified, and there the infinitive again is just, is being translated as is justified, but the idea is we hold a man to be justified by faith, or we reckon a man to be justified by faith, is the literal idea. And then we're using present tenses for both of those as far as the English translation is concerned, even though the infinitive, of course, has no tense idea, but they're drawing that from the tense of the main verb. And I would probably prefer, I don't think I'd make this a hard and fast rule, but if you see a construction like that, try to translate with an infinitive if you can. Or if you can translate it very literally, do that and then maybe make a paraphrase translation or something like this. Just so that I can see you're getting the idea and recognize the presence of an infinitive there and the idea that's being expressed. Infinitive may express purpose or result. There's lots of ways to express purpose and result in Greek, and infinitive is one of those. And when it's used this way, it is sometimes introduced by hosta, so that. That makes it even more apparent what's happening. So, eothon telonai baptisthenai, tax collectors came to be baptized. The idea there is they came, and just like English, came to be baptized. We use the infinitive the same way. And here we see it, it's pretty literal translation, but you're getting the idea of purpose. Eothen akousai tain sophian solomonos. She came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And here's an example with hosta. Etherapusen autus hosta ton ochlon thalmasai. He healed them so that the crowd marveled. The idea there is the result, I suppose, in this context. Again, a person could translate that he healed them in order that the crowd would marvel, perhaps, although there you usually find it subjunctive or something. The fact that the indicative mood would indicate more of the result. And, of course, that's one of the elements of context that helps you decide whether it's meaning result, as it is translation here, with the result that or so that, or whether it's referring to purpose idea. Okay, it kind of has to do with the tenses of the verbs associated and so forth. And usually you'll pick it up quite easily just by a literal translation. Okay, and that's what his last statement has to do with there. Now, the next chapter is just getting some more use of the infinitives. and introducing the use of articular infinitives. So far, we've only been looking at anarthrous infinitives, infinitives with no article. Since an infinitive is a noun type of word, it's functioning like a noun anyway, it can take the article, and we'll see some examples of its use that way here in this chapter. First of all, looking at the first uses listed here, anarthrous infinitive may serve as the subject of a sentence. In particular, anarthrous infinitives occur as subjects, quote, of impersonal verbs such as de or existed. So we can see this verb de or exist in both of them are impersonal verbs. They're kind of third person forms, but they're impersonal. There's no stated subject here, and that's why they put subjects in quotes here, and the infinitive kind of functioning as the subject here, although it's not a person clearly. So it is good for us to be here, or the idea here, kalon esten himas hode enai. The idea there is literally for to be here is good for us. To be here, being here is good for us. The idea there is that the being here is the thing that is good, and it's functioning as the subject of this impersonal idea. And then another one using de me lalesai, I must speak, or it is necessary for me to speak, or to speak is necessary for me, is the real idea. To speak is necessary for me. And the for me is coming from the me there. And that could also be considered as the accusative subject of the infinitive, I suppose, as well. These things get a little bit complicated in their analysis, just because it's a bit different than what English does. Ede plerothenai ten graphein. The scripture had to be fulfilled, or it was necessary for the scripture to be fulfilled, or to be the scripture being fulfilled, or the scripture to be fulfilled was necessary. So that whole thing is functioning as the subject of this impersonal verb. Okay, anarthrous infinitives may occur as adjuncts of certain nouns and adjectives. So just like it can complete these complementary verb type ideas and become a complementary infinitive, the same kind of thing happens with nouns or adjectives. I'll read the first example here. Ego creon echo hypot su baptisthenai. I have need to be baptized by you. Okay, creon means need. And here it's being, I have need for what? I have need to be baptized. So the phrase baptisthenai is serving as an adjunct to that noun and telling you more about what kind of a need it is. Need to be baptized, that kind of need. Same thing can happen with an adjective. Exousion, for example, here. He gave them power to become the children of God. Exousion technefe ugenestai. So it's exousion, authority, and then genestai here, power to become. This hikon noi there in the next example is one where you find an adjective that's used this way. And shall be able to teach. Able would be a predicate adjective in this case, and then to teach is an infinitive adjunct to that. Okay. Then thirdly, in a use similar to that I mentioned above, anarthrous infinitives may be an apposition to a noun. So here, this is the will of God. This is tothelema, the will of God, to keep yourself from immorality. And apechesai would be the infinitive that's in apposition to thelema, telling you what that will is. Fourth example, anarthrous infinitive may be used after the word prin or the phrase prin a, both of which in such a construction mean before. So here's just before something happened, you see. In this case, before Abraham came to be, I am. Then rarely in the New Testament, the infinitive may be used independently as an imperative. That doesn't happen too often, especially when you're dealing with more of a conceptual thing. So chreyan meta, etc., and rejoice with those who rejoice. That's not very frequent. Once in the New Testament, the infinitive is used in parenthetical formula, so to speak. And that's pretty much a straightforward literal translation, so I don't think that presents any real problem, even though it only occurs once. Now the articular infinitive, it's got some uses in common with the anarthrous infinitive, just the article is just giving a little bit more definiteness, more specificity, you might say, to the infinitive idea. It's more of something that's felt. But it can serve, number one, like the anarthrous infinitive, the articular infinitive may serve as a subject of a sentence. So it can function as a subject. Example there, Second point, like the inarticulate infinitive, less commonly the articulate infinitive may serve as a direct object of a verb, so it can serve as a direct object, although it's more common to see direct objects without the article. Then the genitive of the articulate infinitive is used, and this is kind of an interesting use. The genitive form is used with nouns, so here in this usage, you may have to take a double take on it and look at it a little bit more to see this genitive idea, but it does occur quite frequently. We see Eke piston to Sothenai. He has faith to be saved. Maybe a real literal idea trying to translate the genitive would be he has faith of being saved, or he has faith, the kind of faith to be saved. You see, the idea of the genitive is showing the kind or the description of it. So that he's got the to be saved kind of faith. That's kind of the idea that you're seeing here. And, of course, now to be saved is an infinitive idea, and it's modifying the noun in a very genitive sense. So the genitive form here is not at all unusual or unexpected. Then with adjectives, same kind of thing happens there. We are ready to kill him. And here we find an adjective with a genitive phrase attached to it, or an infinitive in the genitive at least, to indicate that same idea. And showing what kind of readiness, ready to kill him, you see, it's a to kill kind of readiness. Then to express purpose or result, another way to express purpose is to use the infinitive in the genitive case. And the difference between this and just using the infinitive in the normal form is just an anarthrous infinitive or something is probably going to be hard to really nail down. It's probably a matter of emphasis more than anything else, although one would probably have to examine a lot of examples to see and to try to ascertain any slight difference. Okay, I won't belabor that one. And then with certain verbs will take a genitive infinitive. I was hindered from coming to you, for example. The verb to hinder here is taking hindered to come or hindered of coming to you. Hindered from coming to you is the way we translate it. Genitive article on the infinitive here. Now notice the infinitive does not change its form. The only way you can tell it's genitive is by the presence of the article. That's why in the anarthrous usage, you mean it's kind of irrelevant to talk about a genitive infinitive in the anarthrous because there's no way to tell. The infinitive doesn't have any endings to indicate anything. Without the article, you wouldn't be able to tell what the case was. Okay, and then the dative of the articulate infinitive used only once in the New Testament expresses cause. That might be debatable, but there's only one example of it, so we'll just have to leave that as it is because I did not find Titus there. Then, unlike the anarthrous infinitive, the articulate infinitive may function as the object of a preposition. This is perhaps the most particular or specific use of the articulate infinitive, and that is as the object of a preposition. And again, it makes some sense to see an articulate infinitive used here because remember, prepositional phrases will govern certain cases. And so certain cases should be made apparent there with the use of the preposition. And some prepositions govern more than one case. And so one would need to have a way of discerning what the case was. And an anarthrous infinitive, you wouldn't be able to tell that. Like I said before, it has no endings. So the articulate infinitive is appropriate for this kind of use. In fact, apparently it's the only one that's used in this kind of construction. And most of the prepositions have their usual meanings. Pro to Elthentain Fiston, before faith came. Pretty straightforward. And then the other examples are straightforward as well. And this part B, in some constructions, the meanings of the prepositions have been specialized. That, to me, is debatable because if you really look at the preposition and get the idea, the root idea of it, I don't think any of these is at all out of order here. Ek to ekain, according to your means, literally out of what you have. And that's pretty straightforward. I don't think there's anything changed about the meaning of the preposition there at all. Ace to enao ton dekaion, in order that he might be righteous. The idea of ace is into. So the idea here is into his being righteous. And I think that's, you know, there's nothing strange about that at all. I don't think the prepositional meaning has been altered in the slightest. Pros to dunas thy humas stenai, in order that you may be able to stand. Here again, pros is the idea of toward, and in the conceptual sense, it's showing purpose. And so it's, again, nothing unusual. And while he blessed him, ento eulogain auton autus, while he blessed them. Here's another example of auton autus, you see, two accusatives there. One of them is him, and then the other is them. And of course, you'd have to look at the context as well to decide which one was which. In this case, you've got them both as pronouns, so you don't really, you have to go by context. This is the only thing you can do. see which one has been referred to previously in the context. Okay, any questions on the use of the infinitive? Mostly it's, I think as far as infinitives are concerned, the main thing is to, when you're reading and translating, recognize that the infinitive is used there, and then just translate it pretty much literally with an English infinitive, see what you come up with, and if it fits, just leave it, and if it doesn't fit, then you may have to do some other, you know, translating in English, but I think the idea of an infinitive is pretty clear and pretty straightforward in Greek. But I suppose about the main thing to watch for is the fact that the subject of an infinitive will be an accusative case if it's not the same as the subject of the main verb. That's the one thing that may trip you up, or you might have some problem with an exegesis. Okay, adverbs, chapter 34. This, again, is not too difficult a chapter except for all the little odds and ends and exceptions and so forth. Mostly it's vocabulary. The meat of this chapter is just learning the vocabulary on page 206, 207 there, just these lists of certain words that have certain characteristic endings. But he discusses adverbs, discusses the formal characteristics of adverbs, and discusses the fact that they're not paradigmatically defined just because they don't have paradigms of endings that they think fit into. And so it's best to define them in a syntactic way, and the fact that they fit into certain locations within sentences. So that's what the first few sections are about. And then he looks in section 264, formal characteristics of adverbs, just shows that in English we do have certain endings that are consistently associated with adverbs. In fact, we can take adjectives and put the little morpheme ly on an adjective and get an adverb idea out of it. So he's just discussing that. And then he'll do something and show the analogy to that in Greek. In Greek, you can also, by a slight morpheme change, convert an adjective into an adverb. And so section 265 is talking about how that's done. Basically, what you do is take the genitive plural form of the adjective, which will always end in omega nu, as you recall. Genitive plural is that very consistent one. And instead of, and then just take the nu off and put a sigma on. So you get an omega sigma ending, and that will be your adverb form. So agnos, for example, pure or chaste, masculine genitive plural would be agnon, or hagnon, excuse me, it's a rough reading. And then the adverb would be hagnos, omega sigma, and it's a pretty simple and straightforward manner of forming a good number of these. And of course, since a participle is a kind of an adjective, adverbs are similarly formed from some participles. So the verb participle own, for example, becoming own tone in the masculine genitive plural, then own tos really in the adverb form. So this is kind of an interesting way to form these, and it's fairly consistent, taking adjectives and forming adverbs out of them. Okay, and then there's a few peculiarities or ramifications. Sometimes you can find an adverb that, for which there's no corresponding adjective that has the same omega sigma ending. So a couple of those, pos, how, and de laugos, clearly they don't have an adjective form apparently in the Greek that corresponds to them. Okay, then in addition to adverbs ending in omega sigma, that's the largest class. He mentions there are about 100 of them in the New Testament of that class. There are other categories as well, and so he's got adverbs ending in ota, adverbs ending in then, adverbs ending in omega, adverbs ending in omicron upsilon, and adverbs ending in iota sigma here, and these particular ending morphemes usually have a kind of an idea associated with them, and it's in common to all of these words. So adverbs ending in ota, for example, are generally dealing with the concept of time somehow. And time orientation, you can look at all of these: when, at some time, then, when, always, at any time, never, never, ever, at any time, when. It's always dealing with time somehow. And so whatever is stuck onto the front of it will indicate either positive or negative, and will indicate, you know, certain other morpheme ideas associated with time. Adverbs ending in then, so you get the idea of from, separation from, that's seen in all of those examples. Adverbs ending in omega deal more with the idea of space and direction, and adverbs ending in omicron and upsilon seem to be somewhat similar in that respect. The idea of where is seen there: elsewhere, everywhere, where, somewhere, where, you see that idea. Adverbs ending in iota sigma have to do with repetition or frequency, the frequency of something. So this is twice, tris is thrice, so forth, pentakis, etc. Five times. Okay, then in addition to these, there are many that have no formal characteristics. They're just adverbs, and they stand all by themselves, and the endings, if you want to call them that, or the form of the word doesn't have any particular morpheme to it, and there's quite a list of these also. And this is mostly vocabulary, like I said before. But their functions are those of adverbs in the sentence. Just a little discussion here of the meaning and use of adverbs. Adverbs express, in section 268, express a variety of meanings, many of which may be classified in a traditional way as adverbs of manner, those which answer the question of how, place, where, time, when, and degree, how much. This classification is not exhaustive, and we should on no account be mistaken for a definition. In Greek, most adverbs ending in omega, sigma, adverbs of manner, adverbs ending in otet, adverbs of time, so we kind of went over that earlier. All right. Then, as far as their positions and sentences and function, 269. In their usual function, adverbs are said to modify verbs, adjectives, or other adverbs. So those are the classes of words that they'll modify: verbs, adjectives, or other adverbs. No special rules can be given for position of adverbs, though in general they follow the verb, adjective, or adverb which they modify. So that's your general rule, is that they're going to follow whatever they modify. But that will not be, of course, pressed in every case, because Greek word order isn't usually so strict. But that's the normal pattern. Then he just breaks it down: adverbs modifying verbs, adverbs modifying adjectives, adverbs modifying adverbs. And then adverbs may be used predicatively, as in English. It was getting late. See, this the adverb late there is being used in a predicate position here. And then the birth of Jesus Christ was thus. Using the verb to be, putting the adverb on the other side of the sentence, just like you would have a predicate nominative or a predicate adjective before. Only now you've got an adverb. All right, adverbs may have attributive positions and functions proper to adjectives. So sometimes they will be put in a position where you would expect an adjective. And of course, when they are, they don't take any declensions or endings. So you have to kind of watch for this. You'll see this kind of thing happen with, we've already seen it with nouns. Remember those appositional uses of nouns? We'll see it with whole prepositional phrases. We'll see it with whole phrases and clauses and so forth. So it's not unusual. And here we see it once in a while with adverbs also. So here he's taken an adverb, since apparently there was no adjective for this. They just used the adverb, the upward call here. And the idea of upward is an adverb here, ano, and tes ano kleseos. One nice thing about these adverbs, though, when you use them as an adjective, is you don't have to decline them. So you can just stick it in there as is, regardless of the case and gender and everything of the noun that you're using to modify. En to nun kairo, at the present time, at the now time, as it were. So using the idea of now, which is normally an adverb, as an adjective. Adverbs may also function as substantives. That's not surprising. Almost anything in Greek can. And so here, and this is kind of an interesting usage too. Apo to nun, from the now, literally. I shall go on to the Gentiles, from the now time, you see. Kind of an interesting use there. And now is now functioning in this context as if it were a noun. Okay, then some adverbs are used as prepositions. So again, they kind of overlap the prepositional kind of usage. With the dative, you've got hama, autois, together with them. And with the genitive, peron, beyond the Jordan, and goose, near the place, plain, except, the idea of except. And these are all using genitive. So they might even be analyzed as a preposition in that given case. I suppose the only reason to say that they're also adverbs is because they're used as adverbs in other instances also. Okay. And it shouldn't be too surprising to find an overlap here, because remember, one of the common functions of a prepositional phrase was adverbial. It was modifying the idea of a verb as well as a noun. In some cases, could be adjectival, could be adverbial. And if you've got adverbial prepositional phrases, and then you've got adverbs also that are kind of functioning without a phrase associated with them, to see them kind of mixed together in a couple places like this shouldn't be too surprising. Okay, then we come to this chapter 35. This one is a little bit more difficult. It was dealing with comparison of adjectives and adverbs, degrees of comparison. And we have certain paradigms for that in English: kind, kinder, kindest, good, better, best, so forth. And then with adverbs, well, better, or best, or soon, sooner, soonest. So we have things where we can express degree. There's a comparative, where one thing is being shown to be a higher degree than another, and then there's a superlative, in English at least, where one thing is said to be in the supreme position over other things. Now, there are morphemes and certain paradigmatic ways of expressing this in Greek also, although they're not quite as consistent and they're not used in all instances. But section 272 shows one of the common ways in which a comparative and a superlative is made from a simple adjective idea. So we've got the adjective hagios, for example, and one of the ways of making a comparative is to add the morpheme teros to the stem there. So we've got hagioteros, or tatos, hagiotatos, for the holiest or most holy. And timios, so we've got timioteros, timiotatos, for the superlative. And so we've got a number of examples here of the same thing. So there's certain morpheme that's being associated with that. Now, adjectives with irregular comparison have their comparative forms in iota, omega, nu, and the superlative in istos. So there's some irregular alternatives to that. And so, like I said, you don't have an absolute hard and fast rule here. For example, if you look at agathos, we have krason or kraton for the better form, and you have that omega, nu ending. And then the superlative is kratistos. We've got istos rather than tatos, which we had before. So there are kind of two morpheme systems for this. And like I say, you really won't be able to necessarily predict which one's going to follow which. You just have to learn them, part of the vocabulary. Now, section 273, adverbs may be formed from comparative forms in the manner described in section 265. So if you remember that manner of making things in section 265, you can apply that to these comparatives. In other words, make your comparative adjective and then convert it into an adverb according to this change of using the genitive plural form and then changing the nu to a sigma. So we've got parasos, for example, as an adjective. The adverb would be parasos omega sigma beneath it there to get exceedingly. And we've got parasoteros, more abundant, and to convert that to an adverb, you just do the same thing. Put omega sigma there and you get parasoteros with omega sigma, and that would be more especially in an adverb sense. So that's pretty straightforward there. However, he says, more generally, the neuter singular nominative accusative of the comparative and the neuter plural nominative or accusative of the superlative are used adverbially. The neuter singular nominative or accusative of the positive degree is also frequently used in this way. So what they will more generally do in order to get an adverb of comparison is to use the neuter singular form or plural form in the nominative accusative. Of course, that form will be the same. So here we see examples. Takus, for example, the adverb is takeos, or taku, another optional form for quickly. And then if you look at the comparative of that, you see what's happened there. We've got takion omega nu up there for the form, but we've got takion with omicron nu. That's the same as your neuter nominative or singular form for the adjective. And takista, that one kind of goes to the iota sigma morpheme, but then the ending is still, if you look at the superlative of the adjective and just make the neuter plural of that, you'd get takista. So that's probably the way to look at it. All right. I don't know how much time is worth spending on some things like this, because you don't see adverbs that frequently, or comparison or degrees. They're relatively infrequent in the New Testament. It's usually pretty straightforward. When you run into one, you may have to look it up to remind yourself, but they're going to generally follow these basic patterns. Then you have the irregularities, of course, and section 274 lists some of those. We've got el and beltion. In other words, they come from completely different roots, and sometimes you can't even tell what they're going to do. Then section 275, the comparative and superlative degrees of adjectives and adverbs may also be indicated by malon, more, and malesta. Just like in English, where we'll put the word more or most in front of something instead of changing the endings on it, that'll happen in Greek also. And that makes it kind of easy when you see that. So then you just see a word for more. So makarion est in malon didonai, it is more blessed to give. So we'll get the malon there is the thing that's giving the comparison. And you're just using the normal form of the adjective. Okay, then in section 276, the word than, or the idea of than, with the comparative is expressed in Greek by the particle a, followed by the same case as that of the noun or pronoun being compared, or by the genitive. So there's two ways of doing it. And we've looked at this, it was kind of the end of one of the chapters before, just kind of a quick statement about the same kind of thing. So it's not brand new here, but section 159, I guess, is what he's referring back to. So getting a comparison or the idea of than can be done one of two ways, either using the particle a and then you use the same case, for example here, John 4:1, Jesus pleonas mathetas poi a kai baptize a Ioannes. Okay, it's comparing Jesus and John, and so the particle a is used here and John is put in the same case as Jesus was earlier. So, and then pleonas is giving the idea of more. And so you can see that it is a comparison. But the thing that's actually being compared is Jesus versus John. Then that second to the last example, we see the other way to do it, and that's to use the genitive rather than using the particle a. So, estai he escate plane keron tes protes. The last fraud will be worse than the first. Now, literally, this is perhaps very close. It's very close to a Hebrew idiom. The way the Hebrews express comparison is to use the preposition from, using that in front of the noun, and that's very similar to this kind of an ablative or genitive idea that's used here. So, the last fraud will be worse from the first. The idea is that it's going to be worse in. If you're moving down a line of degrees, this one is worse from the first. In other words, if you kind of think of a line here of degree, one is at a certain position along the line, the other one is further down from this one on the line, and that at least helps me remember how this idiom works. For the Hebrew students, there shouldn't be any problem. It's just a matter of kind of a direct translation of the Hebrew idea, although you're using the genitive rather than a preposition here. Okay, then once in a while you'll see this idea of than expressed by para or huper with the accusative case. So para, you see, is beside, and that's a very appropriate one for comparison. This is better than this, or this is better beside this. And the idea of huper is over, you see. This is over, you know, these are wiser over these, that kind of an idea. And that's, I think, pretty straightforward too, real easy to recognize. Then a few little tidbits at the end here. Section 277, the superlative occurs only once in its truest sense, highest degree as compared with others in the Greek, and according to the strictest sect and so forth. This whole idea of comparative and superlatives and the way they're used in Greek is somewhat of a debatable area, and I think it's deserving of some more study. It may be something having to do, you know, see, section 278 is kind of what I'm zeroing in on. The superlative form usually has elative meaning. They indicate a very high degree without any comparison with other terms being implied. So you kind of use the superlative form if you're not necessarily making a direct comparison, just using an intensive sense is what he's saying. This may be all right. This example seemed to support it, but it's one of those things that I kind of like to see some more work done on. Its radiance was like a very precious stone. You see, the Greek is literally a most precious. This is the superlative form, a most precious stone. Sometimes we can do that in English also. And I think it's fairly close to the idea that we have as far as the superlative is concerned. The comparative forms are frequently used where a superlative would be used in English, where he says the greatest of these is love, for example. Literally, it's just the greater of these is love. And this may be just idiomatic. It's hard to really conclude here that this has got a superlative function. It may be from using the forms plus the context that we're getting a superlative idea, But I would hesitate to say that the comparative forms are superlative in Greek just on the basis of some of these things. I think it's more something of idiomatic usage and taking the context plus the comparative form to give you those ideas. Okay. Comparative forms are also frequently used in an elative sense. The idea of, you know, I've sent him very eagerly or more eagerly, you see, the more eagerly. Sometimes even the King James will translate it in a comparative sense and then just translate it in literally, and then we supply the idiomatic sense in English. And I think that can be done as well without having to worry about translating something as elative, as it were. Just kind of translate it the way it is and let the context pick up that elative sense. That's usually what happens, and I think that's probably a safer way to go. Okay, now, as if we didn't need anything more, the next chapter gives us irregular adjectives. And these are irregular either formally in the first few or in some of them just in the way they happen to be used in a sentence. And these formal ones, megas, for example, and polus and diplus and porphyrus, these paradigms, your major problems are in your nominative and accusative singulars, both masculine and neuter. And usually what happens is you get some sort of a contraction or vowel type of thing, something analogous to what we saw in some of our third declension nouns. And so that's the main thing. You've got underlined the forms that are irregular here, and so if you can take note of that. They usually involve the fact that their forms have either kind of a mix of third and second declension type of ideas, or it's just an irregularity in those forms that you didn't expect to see. There was no assimilation of the nu, instead the sigma appeared, or something of that nature took place. So that's about the size of it, I guess. These, of course, the paradigms are basically your normal second, first, second type declension nouns, but your irregularities are occurring in these nominative and accusative positions. So it's just a matter of memorization, I guess. He says something here in section 284 about contracted forms. That is, like contract verbs, they have forms which in the earlier stage of the language had epsilon or omicron preceding the stem vowel and case number suffix. So that may be a possibility here. They certainly look like contract forms. But then it's hard to explain why the contraction didn't occur throughout the paradigm, where that little morpheme disappeared in the genitive and dative forms, in the plural forms. So whichever way you want to look at it, the main thing is just to note the paradigm change. Okay, then melas, black here at the bottom of the page, declined as follows, so they give the declension of it. It's not so strange as far as the declension. I suppose the main thing is the feminine forms having a different base, melina, and the rest of it is pretty straightforward third declension type of endings. Then section 286, hekon, hekusa, hekon, willing, so forth, and then you get negatives of those are declined like present participles. Nothing strange there, I suppose. Pas, hapas, and holos may be treated together. And pas and hapas are declined like first aorist participles. So the nominative you have pas, pasan, pan, and so forth, just like a first aorist participle. Then holos is declined like kalos. These three words are roughly synonymous. Their use in the New Testament is indicated as follows. So we have hapas occurring comparatively infrequently, and it has either of the predicate positions with articular nouns means all of or the whole of. And then with a pronoun it means all, and with a participle it means all or everything or all who or, you know, or everyone who. Without a substantive, it means all, everyone, or everything. So its meanings are pretty much the same as pas. Pas follows after this. But that pas is the more frequent one. It's a shorter form, and it's more frequent. And so pas there meaning all or every, depending on the context, or the whole of. It kind of depends on what the noun that follows it is. And usually it's not too bad as far as translation is concerned, because it kind of follows what English will require. You'll see pas on something, and once you see what the something is, it'll pretty well determine whether you're going to translate it all or every. So pas occurs with anarthrous nouns, with articulate nouns, with participles, with pronouns, so forth, just about any way that you'd normally see an adjective functioning. And so he breaks this down. This one perhaps is worth spending a little more time with because it's so common. First, with an anarthrous noun, it usually precedes what may follow. And in the singular, it means every kind of, and if the context allows it, all. So pandendron, for example, would be every tree or every kind of tree. Passa sarx, all flesh. Meta parisias passes, with all boldness. So with anarthrous nouns here, again, we're seeing it either before or after. And its meaning either being every or all, depending on whether the noun itself in its meaning, sometimes the noun may be singular, but it may be have a collective idea, and or a kind of a broad idea, and then you use the word all. If it's a very specific and narrow idea, a specific object or something like this, then you would say every. So that's basically the distinction. With names of places, it means all or the whole of. Pasa Yerusaluma, all Jerusalem. See, that makes sense, too. You wouldn't want to say every Jerusalem since there's only one of them. So the idea of all Jerusalem would be very appropriate there. Because, again, Jerusalem is a place that has got a certain extent, and you can be talking about all the people in Jerusalem. In the plural, it means all. And so if you've got plural things, then it's going to have to be translated all, and that's pretty well the same as happens in English. If you've got a plural noun, then you're gonna have to translate it all. You wouldn't say every men. You'd say every man maybe if it was singular, but or you would say all men if it's plural. All right. Then part B, with an articular noun, pos may occur in either predicate position or in the first attributive position. So this one's again like some things we've seen before, it won't occur in your second attributive position, only in the first attributive position. And then either in either of the predicate positions. So the first predicate position is most common. The meanings all or the whole of are most usually associated with this position. Excuse me. Pasa hektisis, the whole creation or all the creation. Pasai hai genai, all generations, all the generations. Then when pos has this position, a demonstrative may occur in the second predicate position. Remember that demonstrative adjective is going to occur in predicate positions here. So if they've put pos in the first one, then you have to put the other in the second. Pasai hai parthenoi ekenai, all those virgins, those coming from that ekenai. Okay, when pos has the second predicate position, in other words, following the whole phrase, the noun it follows receives special emphasis. This position is not very common in the New Testament. And you can almost feel the difference here. Hoi mathetai pontes. Instead of saying pontes hoi mathetai, all the disciples, when you say hoi mathetai pontes, you're saying in a kind of literal sense, the disciples all, or it's got a little bit more emphasis on the idea of all, because it's kind of being, you know, you read the other first and then you see the word all. It's not the normal position where it's found, and it draws more attention to it and therefore puts more emphasis on it. So that's again more of an emphasis difference. Okay, the rest of these examples I think are all pretty straightforward, using with participles, with pronouns, with a noun, and the same kind of distinction between all or every is going to be observed. It just has to do basically between the idea of singular or plural or the extent of the thing that you're talking about. Holos at the bottom of page 3, or page 218, number 3 here. Holos may occur with an anarthrous noun or in either predicate position with an articular noun. The Greek New Testament holos never has attributive position with an articular noun, nor does it occur in the plural. So the holos is a pretty... It may be that our English word whole came from this Greek word as a transliteration. I don't know. It's a possibility anyway. But the idea of whole, I made a whole man well, or a whole, you can just translate that as whole pretty much everywhere. Then hekastos in section 288 occurs infrequently as an adjective meaning each, every, but more often as a pronoun, each one or everyone. So it's going to be seen more often as a pronoun than it will even as an adjective, and it's probably considered a substantive form of an adjective. Number one here, as far as the breakdown, as an adjective, it does not in the Greek Testament, New Testament, occur with the article. Now, he's coming short of saying that there's a rule that it can't be used with the article, just saying that in the Greek New Testament, it's not used with an article. So hekaston dendron, each tree. You see, this idea of hekastos has almost got a definiteness to it without an article. To say each is kind of pointing to a certain kind of definiteness anyway. And then Hekastein every day, Hekastein Himeron every day. It's kind of a definiteness, but an indefiniteness, you know. You're talking about individual days, but you've got a whole number of them that you're dealing with usually. Okay, I guess that's only the first spell. Okay, the clock is wrong. Finish up this chapter, I think, here. I don't know if I'll go through all the individual uses. I think this is kind of, you know, treat them one-on-one. It's the kind of word that you usually recognize and be able to translate without any problem. Okay, the numeral section, chapter 37. This is mostly just vocabulary, just learning some vocabulary on this. We find that the first four numbers here have a certain declension to them, certain pattern for them, and the number for one occurs in separate forms for the genders, heis, mia, and hen, and then the paradigm is there. Of course, it has no plural forms, which makes sense for the word one, unless you're a Trinitarian, I suppose. And then the word two has just the same forms for all the genders. In fact, all three out of the four forms are the same. You just have duo, duo, duci, and duo. So the data form is the only one that's got anything unusual about it. And these are, of course, obviously plural ideas. Then the number three, masculine and feminine, for one paradigm and neuter for the other, and same with number four. Then the remaining cardinals below 200 are not declined except for those whose forms contain one of the first four as a constituent part. So if you've got, you know, 21, for example, you're going to have the number for 20, which isn't declined, and then the number for heis, 1, which will be declined. So if it's got part of one of those in it, that part will be declined. All right, then they talk about the symbols, and the symbols are basically the letters of the Greek alphabet, with the exception of another symbol, this stigma or digamma. It's written kind of like a sigma with a longer four-stroke on it. The kopa, which is the number for 90, looks like a little lollipop or number 9 or something. And san or sampi, which has two various forms here. Almost looks like a branding iron mark at a ranch or something. And other than that, you're just using the letters of the alphabet. So the whole works is given here in section 292. And this is good for a quick reference in case you run across a number, especially with the higher numbers and you can't remember which it is. You can run back to this real quick. As far as these symbols are concerned, you don't see those very often. I think some of the manuscripts vary in whether they use the symbol for a number or write out the whole number. There's a section, this 293 here, says the numerals were combined by writing one after another. That's the number of the beast in Revelation and so forth. And lists the whole thing out in written form. But then in some manuscripts of the Greek New Testament, the symbols are used. So apparently some manuscripts use symbols and some manuscripts wrote it all out, at least in this passage. I don't know how consistent that is. Okay. We did a little few exercises on writing numbers out and so forth, and I think you can just review that on your own without any problem. Then just a few examples of the use of numbers in Scripture. Then a few other odds and ends. Section 295. Note that the numeral heis frequently occurs with hekastos, each one, you see. That idea is it's pretty much the same as what we see in English in that respect. Then we find this section on allos and heteros. And allos is declined like autos. It's got that allo in the nominative accusative singular. Heteros is declined like an ordinary adjective. And then he says they're basically synonymous. But like I said, I take exception to that idea. They're not exactly synonymous. You can see quite a consistent difference. In fact, there's a passage in Galatians that makes a real distinction between the two, talking about a gospel which is another gospel which is not another, the way the King James comes out. But it makes a distinction between this allos and heteros. And a heteros gospel which is not an allos is what it's basically saying. In other words, the idea of heteros is the idea of different, a different one, another different one, whereas the idea of allos doesn't necessarily imply a difference, it just implies an additional one. And so it may be a subtle distinction in some context, but it's something I think we should at least keep in mind when we're doing analysis like this, especially in view of that Galatians passage, which I don't think he even refers to here. So I find that very strange. That would be the first thing that would come to my mind, to show a distinction between these two words. But I suppose if you're wanting to say that they're synonymous, you wouldn't want to refer to that verse. Okay, we talked about that earlier. So as far as forms and so forth, there's nothing unusual about those. Chapter 38 was on negatives, and that chapter was done largely in your workbook. So to really adequately review this chapter, you probably want to take a look at your workbook on that. and the exercises you did, because that's where you made many of these inductive observations. The basic thing we saw, though, is we had two kinds of negatives, forms with u and forms with may. And the forms with u were used in the indicative, and the forms with may were used for the infinitives and participles. And so that was the major distinction that we saw, and the rest of it is mainly vocabulary. So maybe we'll take a quick look at our workbook on that. If you want to bring that with you tomorrow, we'll take a quick look at that. And then we'll go through the next couple of chapters here, and then we'll be right up to where we were. So all we have left then are looking at the questions, and I think we do need to review that. Relative clauses in chapter 40, we do need to review that. And then we'll be to where we were in chapter 41. Okay, so if you want to bring your workbook tomorrow, go ahead and do that so we can look at that real quickly, and then we'll be needing to bring it pretty consistently from now on anyway, since we're going to get back to exercises. Good.